Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
So glad you tuned in to Radical Philosophy. I'm your host, Beth Matthews. Today on the program, we're speaking with Sandy Jeffs about the philosophy of poetry, and this is part two of a two-part interview. Welcome back to the program, Sandy.
Oh, thanks for having me, Beth. It's great to be here.
Now, last month we finished on you speaking about Larundel, so would you like to continue and speak a bit more about your time there?
Yeah, I had lots of admissions there. Between 1978 and 91, I think I had seven admissions to Larundel. It was out in Bundoora on Plenty Road, just up from La Trobe University. In fact, La Trobe University was built on land excised from the Larundel parcel. In fact, Larundel sat on initially 1,200 acres because the government bought 1,200 acres in 1912. To put hospitals on it. So on that parcel of land, there was Larundel, Mont Park and Plenty, three psychiatric hospitals. And it was an enormous parcel of land. And back in the day, it ran stock, it had cattle, it had sheep, it had orchards, it had market gardens. There still is a golf course that was on the grounds. It was a self-contained mad village, as I call it. It had everything there. And when I was a patient there in the 70s, 80s and early 90s, probably had about 700 to 800 patients in the hospital at Larundel. It was seen in the 1970s as a place of innovation and optimism by staff in particular. It was a very important teaching hospital for nursing. It had the Muriel Yarrington School of Psychiatric Nursing there, where a lot of people did their nursing training. And it was the apprenticeship model nursing training. So the staff, the students who did their training there were with patients from day one. So they learned how to be with psych patients from day one. And that was important because these days people do a nursing degree. They might do an add-on of a psychiatric unit afterwards and do a bit of psych nursing. And then they get to a psych ward. And because they have no idea what they're getting themselves into, they get to a public psych ward and think, oh, God, this is the pits. This is so I can't deal with it. So they sit in the fishbowl doing paperwork and being too afraid to be with the patients in the ward. So that's not a good outcome. So I think losing the apprenticeship model of nursing has been a real blight on nursing training, unfortunately. So Larundel provided that. It was a hellhole for some, a sanctuary for others. It had gardens, had the most beautiful gardens, gum trees, rose bushes, manicured lawns. And you could be in the gardens in daytime and find some quiet, some solitude and a little piece of asylum. By nighttime, this is the paradox of Larundel. It was a dichotomous place. It was a paradox. The gardens by day were beautiful and contemplative and a sanctuary. At nighttime, the gardens were fearful and threatening because there were nooks and crannies, and sometimes bad things happened at nighttime to people because they were dangerous and they were dangerous. So Larundel was this dichotomous paradox. I had mainly a benign experience there, though. I had really only one bad experience. Mostly I got on with the nurses. Mostly I found the nursing to be therapeutic. And it did give me time away from the world, the mad world, to be in this place, a place of madness. But it was my own madness, the madness of my mad comrades. And in a way, we formed alliances in the wards because you were there for a long time. You went there, like these days an admission is days and a few weeks. Back in those days, admissions were for weeks and months. For some people it was years. For some people it was life. There were the back wards where people were institutionalised and forgotten. In a way it was out of sight, out of mind in Larundel. But being out of sight, out of mind meant that you're away from the mad world. So for me it was a very interesting experience. I saw the best and worst of humanity there. I saw the best and worst of myself there. And having that opportunity to see humanity in all its grotesqueness and glory, to have that opportunity was extraordinary. You would not see it elsewhere in the world. Larundel was a mad village, but it provided you with an extraordinary glimpse into humanity.
Yeah. That's really...
And I have got a poem about Larundel that I
could
read.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. That'd be great.
So I'll do that now?
Yes.
Okay. So Larundel was closed in 1999, and from that moment on it became a place for urban explorers and vandals to go and vandalise the buildings. They did put a fence around the buildings, and I did... Twice I risked having a $10,000 fine by breaching the barriers and going into the wards. And I went into the wards with some friends, took photos of all the vandalism, all the trashedness of it, the way it had been just destroyed by people. It was so sad. Places where I had sat had been destroyed by vandals. So I went in and just walked around the place, and it gave me a sense that I have to write a poem that pays homage to Larundel and what it was. And so I wrote a poem called Alice in Larundel Land, and the title comes from a pantomime which was performed there by the staff in 1979. Len Blair at the time was a chaplain at Larundel. He wrote the libretto, and Tony Owen was a consultant psychiatrist. He was a great piano player. He could play anything on the piano. He'd come into our ward meetings on Friday mornings, sit at the piano and take requests. He was a fantastic pianist. He did the music for the pantomime. So that's why I called the poem Alice in Larundel Land. Alice fell down a rabbit hole and landed in topsy-turvy Larundel Land, locked up, captive to lunacy and a passing parade of mad hatters and march hares, eccentrics and musos and artists and a poet or two, and ordinary folk with the deepest sorrows, an inconceivable lunacy, sharing delusions like needles, voices babbling in the background, ECT before breakfast, Stelazine for lunch, Prothioidin for dinner, Mellorol at supper time, and to bed with a hallucination and a moggy. That's a mogadon, not a cat, by the way. A place full of hunger. Hunger for kindness, friendship, love. A curious, secluded world, its dark side kept well hidden. Shadow-haunted inmates longing for peace with themselves. No one knowing the wars that rage within, or the deep pain wedged between spirit and flesh, destroying lives, friends and family picking up the pieces. Larundel Land's red brick walls now rubble, windows shattered, graffiti telling another story, a playground for vandals and urban explorers. Once peaceful gardens dismembered. Somber ghosts roam the precinct, calling us to remember them. We will remember you, sitting in smoky rooms, crying alone, laughing with deranged angels, muddled and paranoid, chaotic and manic, anarchic and confused, prisoners stalking locked wards, keys jangling, medication trolleys rumbling into melancholic rooms, and the humour, the blacker-than-black humour, the cut-through-all-the-crap and misery humour. You will not be forgotten. We shall erect a monument to commemorate all who passed through Larundel Land. We will remember the hellhole and sanctuary, the bottomless pit of despair, unexpected place of healing. Alice landed on her head in upside-down Larundel Land, the madhouse that once stood on the edge of town where time dawdled and everyone hid in the shadows.
Oh, that's so powerful. It really is. Ah, jeez.
And I think the idea now that asylum, the word and the concept, has been completely trashed by the terrible debate we've had on the asylum seekers and refugees, and how we associate asylum with queue jumpers, you know, and boat people, and how we've demonised them. And the concept of asylum being a sanctuary, a safe place, has been completely lost in a terrible, terrible political debate we've had. And even now, public psych wards don't offer people asylum. They just contain them, medicate them, chuck them out mad because someone mad and needs their bed. The whole idea of asylum has been lost in our mental health system and in our community as a concept.
Yeah, I think it has been. Is there a link between mental health and creativity?
It's interesting. I do say these days, if you believe Hollywood, people with schizophrenia are either mass murderers or mad geniuses. And I have to say, no one is ordinary like me. Now, I do ask the question, I have been asking the question, how would it be if we didn't have any mad geniuses in our world? Do we need a mad genius to I don't know, to shine us a light somewhere, to give us a beacon, to do something? If there are no mad geniuses, how would we be? So it's very interesting. It's an interesting thing to ponder. But, you know, if I look at my mad comrades and their delusions and how creative delusions can be. Honestly, you're going to have a whole cosmology, a whole understanding of the world, very intricately intricately drawn, how there are associations made with things, there's connections made with things, these things mean that, there's meanings here, meanings there. The whole thing is an intricate little web of meanings, all based on an unreality, how it's like an artwork you can't share with the rest of the world. I'm in awe of their creativity and how it looks so frighteningly creative. It's extraordinary. So if you want to see creativity under that lens, it's an incredible experience, and it's a mind where the imagination is working in overdrive. It's extraordinary. But in a way, the mad genius is a trope and a bit of a romanticisation of madness, because a lot of people who are mad are not geniuses and are not creative. But some people are. And does their psychosis, their schizophrenia, their mental illness heighten their creativity? I'm not sure, but it does show you parts of life you would never see elsewise or in another guise. So maybe, I don't know. Has madness made me more creative? It's given me something to write about, but has it made me more creative? I don't know. Would I have been creative anyway? I don't know. But certainly it's given me something to write about and to ponder and to investigate. But we do, I don't know, the idea of the mad genius is fascinating. We tend to want to see people as mad geniuses and not allow them to be ordinary. But the fact that we're not allowed to be ordinary, either a mass murderer or a mad genius, we have to be allowed to be ordinary.
Yeah, exactly right. Now, just recently, you've updated your book, Flying with Paper Wings. I love the title. I love the book. And what inspired you to do that?
To update it or write it in the first place?
Well, both.
Both. It wasn't my idea to write my memoir in the first place. Somebody asked me to do it. Jackie Yale, who had been an editor at Ellen & Unwin, I met her through another writer, a friend of mine, and she got to know me and she thought my story was interesting. I didn't think it was very interesting at all, but she thought, no, I had a story to tell. You should try and write a memoir. I was only in my early 50s then, and I thought, I'm too young to write a memoir. It's ridiculous. What would I write about? So I thought, okay, I'll have a crack. So I sat down and I started writing Flying with Paper Wings. Look, I do ask the question, what's more egotistical, writing a memoir or having a psychotic episode? In both instances, you are the centre of the universe, you know. And so is it an ego thing? I don't know. But I wrote it, in terms of writing it, it was a way of, again, processing what has happened to me over the journey of my life and making sense of it and, you know, offering it to a reader. Why would you offer your life to a reader who you don't even know, this stranger reading your words? It's a really weird thing to do. It's like getting up in front of strangers and reading poetry. Why do we do this and expose ourselves to an audience? I don't really know why I've done it, but it was an interesting thing to do. It was a good thing to do. And mind you, during the writing of the initial first iteration of the book, I had two psychotic episodes, so it must have been trauma reminding of certain things that have happened to me, and maybe it sent me mad. Maybe it was menopause that sent me mad. I don't know what it was, but I did do it, and I'm glad I did it. I'm glad, and then updating it. Initially it was published in 2009, so 15 years have passed. A lot has happened in 15 years into my life, in the mental health world, in the world in general. So it was nice to update it because now that I'm old and getting to the point of, you know, maybe pulling up stumps, maybe, I don't know, who knows, I wanted to suppose share with the reader my new life. And in a way, it initially didn't have a happy ending. Now it does. And this is the funny thing. I've resolved my parents. I now see them from a safe distance through sorrowful eyes. That's been a change. I'm now in a better now than I was back when I initially wrote it, because I was more tortured by my parents and the domestic violence I had to witness with them and my sexual assault at 13. I was more connected and traumatized by those things in my life, and now with the help of my psychologist I can see I'm in a better now. And she said, "You're in a better now. Can you see it? You're in a much better now. That was then. Those things were then, and you're in a better now." And I suppose being able to see myself in a better now and feel calmer and more less distressed by what I've experienced as a kid is a good place to be. So it was nice to have a happy ending. I didn't set out to write a happy ending for the last chapter. It forced its way out. The happy ending forced its way onto me, and I couldn't deny it. So that's interesting in itself.
It is. I think everybody loves a story with a happy ending. But you had to keep everybody in suspense for 15 years.
And myself in suspense for 15 years as well. And I didn't realise there was a happy ending until I started writing it. Actually, can I just read a little bit about the
sure.
happy ending?
Yeah, please
I'll just
do.
Read a little bit about it. Where is it? I have to find it. So where is it? Here we go. Where is it? I can't find what I've written. Where is it? I'm trying to find. Here we go. Here it is. Okay. I've been thinking a lot lately about my parents and realise I never really understood or appreciated how miserable they must have been in their awful relationship. How my mother's drinking was perhaps a result of her being trapped in a situation over which she had no control and couldn't easily leave. She had no education or financial independence. Her drinking may have been a form of self-medication to ease her unhappiness. Maybe she was depressed and never received the care she needed. My mother and father were so tragic, two people caught in a web of hate and self-destruction. I wonder, did they ever ask themselves what their bad behaviour was doing to their children? What I witnessed never goes away. So how do I feel about them now? After years of unresolved, conflicting emotions, I see them through sorrowful eyes from a safe distance. Even though I am still affected by their legacy and I can dissolve into a deep melancholy when horrific memories flood my senses, I am less distressed and able to see that that was then and I am in a better now. If only my younger, troubled self, who carried the weighty baggage of childhood trauma, who was condemned all those years ago to irretrievable madness, had a crystal ball in which to see the future, to know that it would be all right.
Yeah, that's amazing. It actually reminds me of a quote. No, I'm sorry, I don't know who wrote the quote, but it says, when we were traumatised children, we were always waiting for an adult to come and save us, but we didn't realise that adult was actually ourselves when we became adults.
Yeah, and that's true. The little girl who was so traumatised and lonely and lost in a silo of her own you know, tragedy and her own pain, she needed help. And it took a long time for me to reach that little girl and hold her hand and say, it's okay, you're going to be okay. If I'd known at 23 when I went crazy, I'd be sitting here now in this situation that I'm in and the much better place that I'm in. If I'd only just known that then. You know, it's taken a long time to get to this point. I'm glad I've arrived here. You know, I don't know. I could go crazy tomorrow. I don't know. Once you've been mad, you always fear that it will come back. And it did come back in 2007, 2009, after a long hiatus. But I feel saner now. If the world's gone crazy, I feel saner. And in fact, the madhouse of the Oval Office makes Larundel look like the sanest place on earth. It really does. And the madness of Trump makes me and my mad comrades look like the sanest people on earth. Honestly, it is crazy out there.
Oh, yeah, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah, but, I think, look, I've read a lot on childhood trauma, and it is that thing of, you know, we're adults now and we can take charge of our own life, you know, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
But it is that thing of, I suppose, we'd like to think we could go back and change things, but we can't. Not unless they find a time machine. here's a question for you, Sandy. Yeah. And I thought that's a bit cliche. I read it on Facebook and it made me think, all right, here's your choice. You can either go back to being 6 years old, knowing what you know now, or you could have $1 million. What would you take?
I don't think I'd take the money. I don't think I'd take the money. But I do say, though, if I could go back to 23 and not go mad, I would go back in a heartbeat to that and never be mad and never experience madness. You know, even though I've had accolades for my work and I've received awards and I've had books published about being mad and all my poetry is about being crazy, all the stuff that I've done, you know, as a result of my madness. And, you know, I think if I could go back and never be mad ever and not go into that psychotic world, I would probably go back in a heartbeat to that moment and not go mad. It's too torturous. It's been too torturous. And even though I'm in a good place now, did I really want to go through all the stuff I've been through to get to this place? Could I have not had a better place back then? I don't know. You know, it's a bit of an imponderable. I'm not a what if person. I'm a what is and what is. So, you know, you can't change things, and you just make the best of what you've been dealt.
Yeah, that's a point. And look, it's an interesting thing you saying, you know, you're fearful of going back to that. But I think, we're only a couple of incidents or maybe one incident away from actually losing our own sanity. And everybody's in that situation. And a friend of mine, once we were out late at night and there was a man who, you know, he had sores on his face, he hadn't washed for a couple of months, he was wearing rags, he was going through the bin. And my friend actually walked up to him and said, "Oh, hello, Mr. Jones, how are you?" And he turned around and looked and he said, "Oh, hello, Carolyn. Oh, I'm very well." And I thought, didn't look very well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they had a brief conversation and me being me, a horrible kid, I said, "Ooh, what'd you speak to him for?" And she said to me, "He was our local doctor. One day his wife and his children were in a car and they were killed. And he walked out of the house and lived on the streets ever since."
Mm.
And I thought, so we're all so close, aren't we?
Yeah, we're a heartbeat away from tragedy. Yes, it's life is precarious. That's why we have to take our privileges and celebrate them and honour them with humility. Like, I look at a lot of my mad comrades who are struggling with obesity, are struggling with type 2 diabetes because of the medications we take. They're struggling to have a place to call home. They're struggling for support. They're struggling for a network. They're struggling for a Team Sandy. You know, I have a Team Sandy. And I think what a privilege that is to have a Team Sandy and have a place to call home, supportive friends, to be able to sit here and do this interview with you. Like, what a privilege that is. And you have to honour it and understand it with humility, because a lot of people don't have the same privileges as other people do. And even though I talk to audiences about being crazy and stuff, I never say I'm a paragon of recovery, because that denigrates people who haven't recovered. I'm not a paragon of recovery. I live with my terrors still. I live with my schizophrenia still. I happen to just be in a little bit of a better place now than I was, and that's a privilege.
Could you tell us about your other books?
Okay, yep, all right. Well, thanks, Beth. We just had recently republished a new edition of Out of the Madhouse, which is now called Out of the Madhouse, From Asylum to Mental Health Reform, Who Cares?, co-authored with Margaret Leggett. It's a book about the mental health. It's a social history of mental health from the 1970s onwards. It looks at medications, treatments, fashions in psychiatry. And the last chapter now takes in the Royal Commission in Victoria and the PR disasters we had with the Joel Couchy stabbing in Bondi Junction. So the book now looks at contemporary mental health, what's happening in that space, and hopefully opening a conversation up about mental health and what needs to be done, how we understand it, how we treat people with mental health conditions, and just how we understand the mess that mental health is in terms of the person's existential experience and the systems around them.
Yes, I agree it is. And it's certainly been a privilege to have you onto the program today. Thanks so much for coming on. And listeners, do tune in next time